Antibiotics prove to be too much of a good thing. We use too much of them and too often. Bacteria, being clever little critters, learn how to recognize bacteria and rebel. To heck with you, they said. And so we now find ourselves in a fix that leads us to ask, how can we resist superbugs?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now, get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1221st edition of the Food Chain Radio Show. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Tepique who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, talk about a good thing. The discovery of antibiotics enabled us to beat back bacteria and survive what had been a debilitating and fatal diseases. Antibiotics proved to be such a good thing that we began to use them indiscriminately and prophylactically. For example, we now feed the animals we eat somewhere in the neighborhood of 50 million pounds of antibiotics every year to help them survive the industrial settings of modern animal agriculture. And we use them on ourselves to treat multiple maladies for which they have no effect, like the virus infections and colds and flus. Given the extent to which we use antibiotics, some of the bacteria we tried to discourage developed a resistance and became superbugs. Today, an estimated 1 million of us are infected every year by antibiotic-resistant superbugs. And this fix we now find ourselves in leads us to ask, how can we resist superbugs? Well, here to help us find some answers, we have Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, who is the Associate Dean of Global Health Services, a Professor of Medicine, and Co-Director of the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics at UCSD. Dr. Stephanie, welcome to the Food Chain.
Hi, it's a pleasure to join you today.
Now, we understand you're also an author. Is that true?
Yes. The story that I'm about to tell you today led to a book that my husband and I wrote called The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug.
Wow. And that, of course, is something we're going to pick up very shortly. But before we do, what do you do in your spare time?
Well, I just wrote another book, if you don't believe it. This one's about a pandemic, and boy, it all came true already, so I better rush and get that out there.
Yeah, I think so. I think you better do that right away. So you're a dean, and you're a dean of Global Health Services. What is that?
It's Global Health Sciences. So essentially, sciences. Global health is addressing health problems that transcend national borders, and superbugs are definitely part of that problem.
Boy, I guess so. And you are a professor of medicine, so you teach, right?
Well, I do mostly research. I'm an infectious disease epidemiologist, so I have a PhD in epidemiology, but not an MD. So that's important because part of this story, I had to learn a lot about medicine in order to, come up with the idea to try to save my husband's life.
Yep. You are a director, right, of the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics. Now, I'll bet there's a lot of people who have no idea what a phage is, which, of course, is where we're going to go today. But first, as I cruise through my history of doing Food Chain Radio and hosting healers and doctors, it seems like many of them have run up against an instance in which they were in big trouble and somehow worked their way out of that trouble, and in doing so, became a healer. And that would be your story as well, correct?
Yeah, I guess you could call it that.
Okay. So, some time ago, not too many years ago, you and your husband, who was also a professor of psychiatry, I believe, at UCSD, mm-hmm. Were on vacation in Egypt.
That's right. My husband and I were on vacation over Thanksgiving of 2015, so about 4.5 years ago. And he wanted to see the Valley of the Kings, and we were having this wonderful meal on top of a cruise ship, and the next day we were supposed to go see King Tut's tomb. And all of a sudden he came down with what appeared to be food poisoning. I mean, he was vomiting uncontrollably and just feeling terrible, couldn't keep anything down. And, I just kind of poo-pooed it because...
Because you're in Egypt, and what else happens when you're in Egypt, right?
And he'd just eaten, seafood meal.
Ooh.
So, but when he wasn't getting any better after 24 hours, we called a doctor to the ship. The doctor gave him intravenous antibiotics and some fluids and said he's going to be fine in a couple hours, and he wasn't. He was worse, and then he started complaining of back pain. Well, I, at this point, realized that we weren't dealing with food poisoning. I didn't really know what it was.
No, just before you go on, you were a virologist, weren't you?
I'm an epidemiologist.
And
I do have a degree in microbiology. It's very rusty from the 1980s, but mm-hmm. It did come in handy in this case because...
So you're a person who has a pretty good idea of what's what. What's eating
well,
what?
Well, yeah, I certainly thought I did. And, this is a very humbling experience because when my husband was ultimately taken to a clinic in Luxor, there was no hospital there. He was diagnosed with pancreatitis, which is an inflammation of the pancreas. But it turns out that was just a symptom of a much bigger problem. This gallstone had stuck in his bile duct, caused a giant abscess to form, and that ended up being a beautiful little apartment for this superbug to move into. And that's what ended up taking him down. So we had him medevaced first to Germany and then back home to San Diego. And in Germany, they diagnosed the superbug that was living inside this abscess in his abdomen, and they said, wow, this is the worst bacteria on the planet.
That's good news.
Yeah, well, I was pretty scared.
The worst superbug on the planet, and it's living inside your husband.
Well, it was a bit of a shock because this is an organism. Its full name is Acinetobacter baumannii, but its nickname is Arachibacter because so many veterans come back from the Middle East with this organism.
Ah.
And, this is an organism. We used to plate on my Petri dishes back in the 1980s, and I thought, how can this be the world's biggest superbug? Well, unfortunately, over the last couple decades, our overuse and misuse of antibiotics, as you've referred to, has led, these organisms that used to be, pretty mundane, ordinary, different bacteria, they've acquired superpowers. This particular bug that my husband had, I refer to it as a bacterial kleptomaniac. It's really good at stealing antibiotic resistance genes from other bacteria. And so he was, medevaced back down to San Diego, and they said, it's now resistant to every single antibiotic.
Whoa. So there's your husband in the hospital with a superbug, and a superbug being a bug that is resistant to all known antibiotics. Oh, my goodness, what does Stephanie do?
Well, superbugs are resistant to multiple antibiotics. In my husband's case, it's very unusual to have it resistant to everything, but the doctor said there's nothing else that we can do. He's fully colonized with this bacteria, and he started to slip away. He was in a coma, and I didn't know if he could hear me, but I decided to ask him what he wanted to do, and I said, if you want to live, please squeeze my hand. And lo and behold, he squeezed my hand. And so I thought, well, I'm dealing with the best infectious disease doctors in the world here, but I feel like if my husband, wants to live, I have to try alternative treatments of some kind. So I went and I hit the internet, and I used the National Library of Medicine search engine called PubMed. That's PubMed. It's a gold mine. Anybody can put in search terms and come up with scientific papers that are, going to inform how to go forward. And I found a paper that mentioned something called phage therapy.
And the address was PubMed?
PubMed, P-U-B-M-E-D.
Mm-hmm. That's simple as that. Mm-hmm. And there you found something called phage therapy. Now, have you ever heard of phages before?
Well, luckily, because I have this rusty degree in microbiology from the University of Toronto from the 1980s, I did know that phages, which is short for bacteriophages, are viruses that have naturally evolved to attack bacteria. They're the natural predator, or the perfect predator, if you will, of bacteria. You know, your show is what it eats what.
What's eating what?
Phages,
yeah.
Phages eat bacteria. That's what they exist to do. And so I thought, wow, you know, I never knew that phages were ever used to treat bacterial infections. That was news to me. But they've been discovered over 100 years ago, and they were used successfully to treat bacterial infections in animals and in people. And then when penicillin came on the scene, they were kind of forgotten in the West. And the only place that they are still being regularly used is the former Soviet Union and parts of Eastern Europe.
Right. And so you ran across this paper on phages, and you thought, a ray of sunshine.
Yeah, so I wrote the head of infectious diseases. I mean, luckily, my colleagues were the ones caring for Tom at our hospital here in San Diego.
Well, you're in one of the best medical complexes in the world right there at UC
San Diego. We're very fortunate. And so I asked them if they would consider this experimental treatment, and they thought, well, you know, Tom's going to die anyway. Let's see if this could help. And so the head of infectious diseases, Dr. Chip Schooley, said to me, look, if you can find phages that match his bacterial isolate, I'll call the FDA and get approval for compassionate use. And so that's the whole experimental drug, you know, process that you have to go through if you want to use something that is unproven and untreated and is not on the market. The FDA has to approve.
So you were fortunate enough to have that connection that you could pull off one of these certificates and get to go.
Certainly, any physician can contact the FDA to get what's called an EIND, an Emergency Investigational New Drug Permission. But where I was very fortunate is that I wrote total strangers and asked them if they had, you know, phages that could be used to treat my husband. And, I used this PubMed search engine to find researchers that were studying phage and studying the kind of organism my husband was infected with. And luckily, strangers from Texas A&M University, Dr. Rye Young and his lab, agreed to help. And I sent them Tom's bacterial isolate. And within a couple of weeks, they had phage, not only that matched, but they found four different phages and grew it up and purified it in time to save his life.
Wow. So you took, a culture of the bacteria that had infected Tom?
Yes, that's right.
So you had a Petri dish full of bugs that you sent to Texas.
Yep, and they worked on that. A graduate student even slept in the laboratory for 2 weeks, and, you know, really, they turned their lab into a command center. We had researchers also from all over the world that were donating phage to help my husband, and even the U.S. Navy stepped in, and they also prepared a phage cocktail. So within 3 weeks, you know, from my first email to when we started this phage therapy on Tom, it was like, you know, it was only 3 weeks. Compare that to an antibiotic that takes, you know, 10 years to develop and over $1 billion.
Wow. Okay. Before we get to the fun part of the story, which is the waking up, we're going to take a quick break. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today, we're honored to have Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, who's turning the world of microbiology upside down with phages, no less. Which we're going to learn a lot about in the coming hour. So we hope you'll stay tuned for this very important program on What's Eating What. Dr. Stephanie Strathdy is with UC San Diego. She is a research scientist and a professor and a co-director and an author and just about everything. And she has spare time to write more books. So stay tuned. She's going to be with us right back.
And now, more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, welcome back. We were talking with Dr. Stephanie Strathdy about her experimental use of phage therapy to save her husband's life. My goodness. How long was he unconscious, Stephanie?
Well, he was in a coma on and off for about 2 months. His whole experience in the hospital was 9 months long. So he was, you know, in a very bad situation. When he got the phages, he was in what's called multi-system organ failure.
Wait a minute, he was 9 months fighting this superbug.
That's right. I mean, by the time he got phage therapy, he was in the hospital about 4 months. It took him a while to recover because he'd lost 100 pounds in all his muscle mass.
100 pounds. And there he is. And he's in multiple organ failure, you said?
That's right. His lungs, heart, and now his kidneys were starting to fail. And so the doctors said, you know, this is a Hail Mary pass in the last minute of the game where the quarterback is blindfolded, throwing a ball 100 yards down the field and hoping to God somebody will catch it. And somebody did.
And he caught it. What happened when you fed him? How did you give them the phages? How does that work?
Well, you know, it depends on where the organism is. In my husband's case, he not only had this giant abscess in his abdomen, but one of the drains that we were using to try to siphon off all that infected fluid slipped inside him, and it had poured all of that gunk, including all of those bacteria, into his bloodstream. So
he underwent
septic shock. He had 7 cases of septic shock during his hospital stay. And that meant that the bacteria was everywhere. So we really had to inject these phages into his bloodstream. And that was the scary part, because even though phages have been used in the former Soviet Union for decades, they generally don't administer them intravenously because there was concern that it wouldn't be safe and that the body would recognize it as foreign and go haywire and the patient would die of septic shock. So that's what the big risk was in this case.
Wow. And so you gave him the phages that came from the University of Texas down there.
And the Navy, yes.
And the Navy. So the Navy was, you said the Navy was in this. What did the Navy do? How were they involved?
It turns out the Navy and the Army in the U.S. and other militaries around the world have been involved in, you know, phage and trying to develop phage banks to address any infections that their veterans get, but also to potentially respond to bioterrorism threats. The Navy had a lot of phages that were, you know, focused on the bacteria that my husband had, but none of them had been tried in humans before. So
wow.
That was another scary thing. I mean, were we going to cure them or were we going to kill them?
So what happened when, I guess you injected these phages into Tom, what happened?
Well, 3 days later, he woke up, lifted his head off the pillow, and kissed his daughter's hand. I mean, everybody in the ICU freaked out. Nobody could believe it was, you know, it was happening. And there was, you know, people crying, and it was just a miracle. And, you know, it was a long recovery, but there's no question.
After 9 months, 3 days of phage therapy.
Well, he got the phages about halfway into his hospital stay. The rest of it was recovery. But,
okay.
You know, we feel that if he'd gotten phage therapy very on in the course of his illness, he could have walked out of the hospital. It's just that this is experimental treatment in the United States. So you have to be, you know, at that time, he had to be dying in order to get it. Nowadays, because my husband's case has reawakened this whole field of phage therapy, it's possible to receive it if you've got a serious infection that is no longer responding to antibiotics.
Well, let's go back and talk a little bit about phages. When I first started doing the Food Chain Radio program, you know, 1,200 editions ago, I ran into a company that was doing phage therapy and was trying to commercialize the whole process, but somehow it kind of faded away. But it's back. So what the heck are phages? I understand there's 10 million trillion trillion phages. Wow.
On the planet. That's right. That's right. Well, what your listeners need to know is that phages are found in nature. I mean, a drop of water may have a trillion phages. 30 billion phages move in and out of our body every single day. So most people have heard of the microbiome, and most people just think of that as all the bacteria. Well, there's the phages in our body that are keeping those bacteria in check. They're the gatekeepers. And they haven't really received a lot of attention up until now. But now we're realizing that phages could be, you know, the enemy of the enemy is our friend. We can get rid of nasty bacteria in our bodies using phages. And this research is in its infancy, but we're very hopeful that it could be used to address the superbug crisis and maybe even to promote wellness and groom the microbiome and some days in the future.
So when we talk about phages, we're talking about the way they control bacteria is essentially invasion of the body snatchers, right?
It's kind of like that. So what happens is, these are, they look a little bit like alien spiders. I mean, there's lots of different kinds of phages, but the kind that people think about look like little baby spiders. They're 100 times smaller than bacteria in most cases, and they attach to the bacteria, and they drill into it, and they insert their genetic material, which is usually DNA, and that DNA takes over the bacterial cell and turns it into kind of like a zombie, and it becomes a phage manufacturing plant. It's no longer making bacteria anymore. It's being programmed to make baby phages, and these baby phages, when given the kill signal, burst out. About 100 to 300 baby ones burst out and kill the bacterial cell, and then they go on to attack more bacteria, and they only attack the bacteria that they match to because there's a receptor on the bacterial cell wall that allows them to get in. Wow. So that's the great part, because they don't kill the other bacteria in our microbiome that are friendly. They only kill the bacteria that they match to, and then they're excreted naturally by the liver and the spleen.
So each phage attacks a specific kind of bacteria.
Right.
Okay. There being 10 billion trillion trillion phages, how on earth do you decide which phage is right? Where do you...
How did you
find Tom's phage in 10 million trillion 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 or whatever it is?
Well, that was the ultimate needle in a haystack that we were concerned about. Once I realized how, onerous this could be, I was really scared, but I had to try. First, I approached researchers that were already studying phages against this organism. And so they already had some characterized, and they, had them sequenced, and they knew a lot about them. But they didn't have enough of those, because you need a phage cocktail in order to treat somebody, because if you only have one phage and it's attacking all these bacteria, the bacteria are multiplying, say, every 20 to 30 minutes, and they become resistant to the phages very quickly. So if you have a phage cocktail, ideally with phages that attack different receptors on the bacteria, then it's less likely that the bacteria is going to become resistant very quickly. So we had to go directly to some crazy places in order to find phages to attack Tom's bacteria.
What does crazy place mean?
Well, where you find a lot of phages is where you find a lot of bacteria. So the best place to find them is in sewage.
Uh-huh.
And
the best place in the world would probably be Egyptian sewage in Cairo.
Yeah, well, we didn't bring any Egyptian sewage back with us. I mean, we did check the bottoms of our boots to see if any of that soil could be used, but it was too, too sparse. And luckily, both the Navy and Texas A&M found phage cocktails that were active against my husband's strain, and that was very fortunate. But now that we've gone on and we've treated many other patients with phage therapy, and most of them have been successful, we're trying to develop a phage bank that would be large so that we would have thousands of phage that would match different bacterial isolates. And then it's very quick to match those phages to someone's infection. It could take, 24 to 48 hours. And then you're good to go, as opposed to having to go to sewage each time.
Kind of a gift you and your husband have given the medical community, if you think about it. Let's back up a little bit, because phage therapy has been used for well over 100 years, correct? Discovered, in 1915 or 17 or something like that?
Yeah, that's right.
So, and used extensively here in the United States in the 20s and 30s.
Right.
What happened?
Well, a number of things happened, and we get into the story in our book a little bit, because it was a big mystery to me of why this was, discovered 100 years ago and is not being used here. And the first thing is that penicillin came on the scene. It was discovered in 1928, but it wasn't until 1942 that it really started to be mass-produced, and that's what became Big Pharma. And phages, because they need to be matched to the bacteria, were thought to be very finicky, and, here we're this penicillin, it's this wonder drug, we can give it to people without even knowing what kind of bacteria they have, and it'll cure them. So that kind of broad spectrum approach of antibiotics was, thought to be a great thing. And, of course, now we know that it's not such a great thing when you're killing all of the bacteria. You're killing friendly bacteria as well as the harmful bacteria. But also the discoverer of phage therapy, Félix de Harel, was kind of an egotistical guy. He was also not formally schooled, so he didn't have like a degree, and he was going up against Nobel laureates who were ridiculing him. And then, of course, what happened was when penicillin came on the scene, it wasn't available very readily in the former Soviet Union, so they continued to use phage. And so it got the reputation of being
a communist drug.
Science.
There you go.
That's right. So that, unfortunately, put a cloud over phage therapy. That geopolitical bias meant that, phage therapy was thought as fringe and, bad science. I mean, phages were discovered before we even knew that DNA had a triple helix, so some of the science wasn't the best at the early days. But unfortunately, in the West, this bias was very pervasive, and it meant that we were not really studying phage in terms of its application for agriculture or people or animals or food safety or any of that. Phages were used as tools and helped discover CRISPR and molecular biology and genetic engineering, but the whole application of them as treatment was just simply forgotten.
Gone. It was messy. It was a messy science. Nobody really knew what they were doing. They're goofing around in petri dishes, and so, and then this miraculous drug came. Just drop the pill and bombs away. All the bugs get killed, and you're okay. And besides, it was a goofy guy that came up with it in the first place.
That's right.
And it's a communist science anyway. So to heck with it. So we left it, and we left it. We put it in a closet and left it there until Stephanie and Tom went to Egypt.
Well, I mean, it certainly has been described as the watershed case that has brought phage therapy back to the West, especially North America. There have been lots of cases of phage therapy around the world and even in the U.S., but what was innovative about my husband's case is that he had a systemic superbug infection, and we injected these phages, a billion phages per dose, into his bloodstream every couple hours. And so the fact that it didn't harm him and cured him made people really sit up and take notice. And now the first clinical trial that the NIH has ever funded is going to be starting to enroll patients this summer at our new center, the Center for Innovative Phage Applications and Therapeutics, IPATH, at UC San Diego. We're the first dedicated phage therapy center in North America, and it had to take this terrible thing to happen to our family in order for us to get to the point we are in. So we see this whole, circumstance as a blessing, and maybe it's the reason we're on the planet.
I have to ask this. Your husband, Tom, is a psychiatrist.
Well, he's a psychologist,
psychologist
by training.
Okay.
He's in the Department of Psychiatry.
Okay. He's a psychologist. Well, what does he think? What an experience for him to go through. Does he remember squeezing your hand?
He does. And, our book, The Perfect Predator, has interludes from Tom because he was in a coma for most of his illness. And his perception of what was going on is very different than what was going on in real life. So his hallucinations, he remembers them just in vivid detail. And we included them. He narrated them to me. I wrote them down. And they're pretty amazing. He has a totally different view of some of the research that he does with people with schizophrenia as a result of his experience.
Wow. Okay, so now, where are we today? Is phage therapy still disreputable among the conventional medical community? Do they still look down at what the heck is that Stephanie Strathdy doing at UCSD?
Well, we've really seen a sea change. Most infectious disease physicians around the U.S. and even in North America have heard of phage therapy now, and they're more open-minded. The average internist or family doctor probably hasn't heard of it. We get patients and doctors contacting us every day now looking for phage therapy. It's still experimental in the U.S. until clinical trials can get completed to show that it works on a broader scale as opposed to just in these single case reports. Until that time, it's possible to get phage therapy if you have a superbug infection that is no longer responding to antibiotics. So you can contact us at ipath@ucsd.edu if that's your situation or someone that you love, and we will try to help.
Okay, folks, there. We're going to take a quick short break coming up here, but in review, what we have is essentially a brand new look at a very old technology. It's been in use since what we've known about it, phages, since 1915, 1917, way back then. We used them extensively here in the United States in the 20s and 30s to address bacterial infections and whatnot. But then we discovered penicillin. What a gift antibiotics were. And they were such a good gift that we used them for everything. We now, 50 million pounds of antibiotics every year on the food animals that we eat. And we use it for things that they don't do any good for, like the flu and whatnot. Doesn't do any good for viral infections. But we are rediscovering it thanks to Stephanie Strathdy and her husband Tom, who went to Egypt. And Tom got an infection, brought it home, and brought phage therapy back to us. When we come back, I would like to ask Dr. Stephanie where this is going to take us. How can we really get behind this new technology? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host. We will be right back.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Welcome back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about phages, bacterial phages, which are essentially predators of bacteria. They're the wolves in the sheep den, I guess you might say, looking to eat the bad bacteria and good bacteria. And what Stephanie and her associates in the medical world are doing are trying, I guess, to catalog which does which. Is that true, Stephanie?
Yes. I mean, we're doing three different things at our Center for Phage Therapy called IPATH at UC San Diego. First, we're moving phage therapy into clinical trials so that if it's shown to be effective.
Brand new. This is brand new, right?
Everything old is new again kind of thing. But we're also, working to help patients who have serious life-threatening bacterial infections that are no longer responding to antibiotics and getting experimental phage therapy for them in the same way that we helped my husband.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that there are over a million of those people in the United States each year. Is that true?
Oh, at least. At this point, there's probably, it's estimated at 700,000 people dying of superbugs every single year, but that's thought to be an underestimate. By the year 2050, one person every 3 seconds, or 10 million people, will be dying per year from superbug infections because we are just not changing the way we're using antibiotics, and that's a big problem.
We're not coming to grips with the fact that we're misusing one of the most precious gifts we've been given.
Right, and see, phages can help us reduce our reliance on antibiotics, and that's something that I think that your listeners really will be interested in. I mean, apart from using phage to treat bacterial infections in humans, phage are also being used to treat, different bacterial infections in agriculture. As early as 2002, the EPA approved phage therapy for tomato rot. There's a couple of different companies in the U.S. that are using phage to treat agricultural products and also meat. Two of them are Intralytics and Omnilytics. The FDA also approved phage therapy to treat contaminated meat that is infected with listeria. And so there's more companies that are moving into this area because we have heard about, the romaine lettuce outbreaks of salmonella and E. coli. If we were to be able to use phage to, treat our produce before it comes to market, then we would be in a position where we would be less likely to have these outbreaks of foodborne illness. And there also phage is being used experimentally to treat infections of bacteria in aquaculture. So, for example, in shrimp and prawn farms, oyster farms, there's different bacteria like the kind that cause cholera that can get into those farms and spread, and it kills all of the produce there. So there's even people that are studying the application of phage in beehives to prevent foul brood. So there's a lot of hope on the horizon for phage to be used also in agriculture to prevent infections with in livestock, because right now 70% of the antibiotics that we use in the world are in many countries are used in livestock to not to prevent and treat infections, but to actually, you know, promote their growth.
Right.
And that's what is the big problem. It isn't so much the antibiotics that are misused in people that are driving this whole superbug crisis. It's their use in agriculture. So we really need to put pressure on the food industry and the agribusiness to stop using antibiotics unnecessarily in agriculture. And there are some companies like Tyson and McDonald's and Wendy's that are changing their practices and are starting to only use antibiotic-free meat. And so your listeners have purchasing power. When you go, if you're already a meat eater, you can buy organic meat. And it's easier to find for poultry right now, but harder to find for beef and pork and lamb. So that's where we need to be using our purchasing power these days, is buying antibiotic-free meat or reducing the amount of meat that we eat.
Amen to that. Now, backing up a little bit, thinking about why phage therapy was so problematic for so long, I'm wondering if the ability to sequence DNA had a big change in you know, the prospects for phage therapy.
Absolutely. I mean, my husband's case, if it had happened, 10 or 20 years ago, we probably wouldn't have been able to save him. The advances that we've seen with what's called high-throughput sequencing that allows us to sequence organisms very quickly is one advance. We've also developed techniques called metagenomics that allows us to find phages that are not culturable. So scientists can find little pieces of DNA and you know, string them together. And in fact, some research teams and biotech companies are even developing synthetic phages. And so that's a whole new area of growth as well.
Wow. Synthetic phages. How do they grow?
Well, I mean, they grow the same way that a natural phage grows, but there's three different kinds of phages now that are under study. So there's natural phages, the 10 million, trillion phages that are on the planet. There's genetically modified phages, so taking those natural phages and clipping out genes or adding genes to make them work better. And the first genetically modified phage cocktail was used to treat a young girl with cystic fibrosis who had a superbug infection in the UK based on the protocol for my husband's case. And she lived, and we're in touch on Facebook, and we're going to visit her if this coronavirus pandemic can turn its head around. But it's a real breakthrough because her infection is a cousin to tuberculosis, the biggest bacterial killer in the world.
Wow.
So synthetic phage and genetically engineered phage are likely to be the future.
Now, you brought up the coronavirus, and of course, we're wondering, would there be a possibility that phages could be used to attack other phages or other virus hunters?
Well, I mean, we've been talking about bacteriophages today,
yes.
And those are,
yeah,
are you know, viruses that attack bacteria. There are viruses that attack other viruses, but we know a lot less about them, and they're usually associated with amoeba. I think that it's a far off prospect, at least at this point, to think that we could use a virus to kill another virus. But, you know, these days we've seen some terrific medical advances, and we need to keep our minds open, because if we hadn't had an open mind to try something that was really out of the box with my husband, you know, I'd be holding his urn of ashes instead of his hand.
Well, in fact, we were not open-minded about it. I mean, if you think about it, we were close-minded about it, and it took something really extraordinary for Stephanie Strathdy to start digging into some very obscure places to find what needed to be found. So it was really somebody going against the closed-mindedness that brought us to you know, the sunshine and fresh air again.
Well, you know, they say the necessity is the mother of invention, right? And so people turn to me and, you know, say, oh, I could never have done what you've done. I said, no, I said, you don't know that, because when your back is up against the wall and someone you love is about to die, you'll do whatever it takes. You know, mothers lifting cars because their baby is underneath or whatever. I mean, it felt like that kind of an effort. But really, it was a global village that stepped up to save my husband's life. So if we can do it for one man, we can do it for the planet.
Mm-hmm. And you pretty much opened the medical world to rethinking phage therapy. And it's probably being picked up in a lot of other different places as well now.
That's right. There's a number of startups and biotechs and pharmas are getting interested, even though in the early days they were just thinking that phage was just crazy. But Janssen, which is now a company that used to be Johnson & Johnson, they just invested $800 million in a phage company in North Carolina to groom the microbiome. And so we're starting to see a real change. And physicians are turning to us when they have a patient who is no longer responding to antibiotics. And so that's a part of my life now. I get contacted by strangers from all over the world who, are a lot like my husband. And I feel like I have a moral obligation to help them because total strangers stepped up to the plate to save my husband.
Now, you brought up another interesting subject that I definitely wanted to get to, and that was the subject of grooming the microbiome. You talk about it as if it's a garden.
Well, it kind of is. I mean, it brings to fore the whole idea of microbial ecology. Because, as I mentioned, most people, when they think about the microbiome, they think of bacteria. But really, they think about the gut. But there are multiple microbiomes in our body, our skin, our gut, our mouths. They're made up not just of bacteria, but the phages that prey on the bacteria and archaea, which are other organisms, and fungi. And we haven't been paying attention to these. It's an interplay between all of these organisms. And some of them are there to do good, and some of them are there and they're not, like they're causing irritable bowel disease or, Crohn's or other kinds of illnesses. And the more we learn about the role of some of these organisms in this, then we can kind of selectively go in and edit the microbiome. And, we're not at that point quite yet, but these are where some of the clinical trials are headed.
I had the occasion once to be in the headwaters of the Amazon, and in thinking back on that experience and considering the concept of the microbiome, I almost think that each and every one of us is a miniature Amazon jungle walking down the street, given the amount of critters that live in and on us.
Absolutely. I think it's a really good metaphor.
Wow. But with respect to grooming the microbiome as we would a garden, so, we bring in beneficial insects to eat the bad insects. We bring in specific nutrients to encourage this growth or that growth. Is that what you're talking about when you're talking about grooming the microbiome?
Yeah, absolutely. And, again, we're not at the point yet where we can make specific dietary recommendations to people on that basis. But there is research being done now to try to figure out, can we induce phages that are kind of asleep inside bacteria in our guts by suggesting that people, use stevia or kombucha or green tea extracts or things like that. I mean, there's some early research that's being done that shows that that could be possible. But at this point, it's too early to really use it as kind of a prescriptive approach. But it's very exciting.
Well, it would certainly seem to be the notion that you can actually tend your microbiome garden as you would your garden. And those who do a good job of tending their gardens might be in a position to do a good job of tending their microbiome as well. If you have that sensitivity, right?
Well, we're made up of a lot of... That's right. We're made up of a lot of microorganisms. And we've got to keep them happy. And so, eating food, fermented food products, for example, are going to feed bacteria that are generally good in our bodies. And so those kinds of things, I think, are pretty harmless for people to do at this point. Where we start to, you know, get into the uncharted territory is, well, what food would get rid of this bacteria? If we want to, you know, promote this bacteria, what do we do? And so that research is still very much in its infancy, but I think it's the future.
Well, now that's pretty interesting. That's the whole notion that we do actually have a tip from Dr. Stephanie Strathdy that if we eat fermented foods, we will be encouraging the microbiome, mostly good bugs. Is there something that we could eat that would discourage the mostly bad bugs?
You know, I'm not at that level of knowledge myself. I mean, I've learned a lot of this by the seat of my pants over the last couple of years, and I read extensively, and I work very closely with the American Gut Project, which is led by Rob Knight and Jack Gilbert here at UC San Diego. They're some of the experts on this, and they take people's poop and analyze it and send them back a report. And for a while, they were just looking at the bacteria, but now they're looking at the phage, too.
Wow. So, Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, by virtue of your husband's illness, you became a pioneer of medicine. And you pretty much picked up most of the knowledge, I think, on your own. Is that true? You've done it on your own.
Well, I had a background in both epidemiology and microbiology, and I have, you know, great connections in the community that I've been able to tap and do a lot of reading myself. So our story is one of privilege. I mean, most people dying from superbug infections are in lower and middle income countries. And so that's one of the reasons my husband and I wrote our book, The Perfect Predator, A Scientist's Race to Save Her Husband from a Deadly Superbug, to raise awareness about superbugs and the potential for phage therapy to be able to address the growing superbug crisis.
Where is all of this going to take us?
Well, hopefully it's going to take us to clinical trials, and that once phage therapy is shown to be efficacious, as I think it will, then the FDA can license it alongside antibiotics. We don't ever think that phage are going to completely replace antibiotics, but they're an important adjunct that can reduce our overdependence on antibiotics.
And we need important adjuncts.
That.
Yes. Dr. Stephanie Strathdy, thank you so much for joining us on the Food Chain today, but thank you so much more for all of the work that you have done to find us a new way to manage our bodies. Thank you. And
thank you.
Yeah, and thank you all out there for tuning in the Food Chain. Remember Michael Olson's third law of the Food Chain? Cheap food isn't. Thank you, Stephanie.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain radio show with Michael Olson. And if your friends miss the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.